Hey there, it's me, Jesse Tyler Ferguson, that redheaded actor from Modern Family. I have a podcast. It's combining a couple of my favorite things, talking and food. Please join me as I dine with the biggest names in entertainment. People like Julie Bowen, Kristen Bell, Fred Armisen, and so many more. It's called Dinners on Me, and you're invited. Am I saying a chocolate souffle is going to get me to reveal all of my secrets? Yeah, I am. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The number of unhoused people in the U.S. is reaching record levels. And today, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case that could change how governments address that growing population.
The central issue is whether governments can ban people from sleeping or camping outside when they have nowhere else to go. And it could be the most consequential case for the rights of unhoused people in decades.
That's Rhys Thibault. He's the West Coast correspondent for The Post. Rhys recently traveled to Grants Pass, Oregon, the city at the center of this case. Like many cities, the unhoused population in Grants Pass has grown a lot in recent years, and many people have been living in public spaces like parks. One of the ways the city has responded is through fines. But some of those unhoused people took the city to court. And today, their lawyers argued before the Supreme Court that punishing them like this is a violation of their constitutional rights, since they have nowhere else to go.
The city interprets and applies the ordinances to permit non-homeless people to rest on blankets in public parks, while a homeless person who does the same thing breaks the law. The ordinances, by design, make it physically impossible for homeless people to live in Grants Pass without facing endless fines and jail time.
From the newsroom of the Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Martine Powers. It's Monday, April 22nd. Today, how a legal challenge brought by unhoused people in Grants Pass could have a massive impact on cities and states across the country. So, Rhys, you went to Grants Pass a few weeks ago. Tell me about why you went there and what this place is like.
Well, Grants Pass is suddenly really important to the national debate on homelessness policy. The city's anti-camping laws are at the heart of this Supreme Court case. But I think the more important point is that far too often in these, you know, political and legal discussions, you lose track of the people who are directly affected, and that's especially common when those people are unhoused. So we thought it was vital to our coverage and to getting the full story to go to Grants Pass and spend time in encampments and with the people who are providing them services. And, you know, you'll hear us throughout this conversation use different terms when we're talking about this community, whether it's unhoused people, people living outside, people experiencing homelessness. You know, I've talked to a lot of people and they use a lot of different terms themselves. So we'll use a lot of those words, you know, interchangeably in this interview. Grants Pass is a pretty small, fairly conservative city in southwestern Oregon. About 40,000 people live there. And as its name suggests, it's surrounded by mountains. You can stand downtown and see them on all sides. And the Rogue River runs through the center of the city. It's beautiful. There are public parks all over. The area used to make money from timber production, but now it relies mostly on tourism. And it's fairly low income. Taxes are among the lowest in the state, and the rates of people on food stamps is pretty high. Like so many cities, especially in the West, there's a major housing crisis. So the population there has doubled in the last couple decades, and there just aren't enough places to live. So not only is there a housing crisis, but there's also a homelessness crisis. Like most places, there's not reliable data on exactly how many people are homeless in Grants Pass, but estimates range from about 600 to 1,200 people, which is high for a city of its size.
So, Rhys, tell me about some of the people that you met there, particularly people who have spent some time sleeping on the streets.
Yeah, I think one important thing to understand is that many of the unhoused people in Grants Pass have strong ties to the area. A lot of people, you know, either grew up there or moved there years before they became homeless. So that means to them, this is their city, it's their community. Mm-hmm. And now, after they lost their homes, they don't feel welcome. And they talk about feeling this in the laws that are on the books. So a court order requires the city to allow people to camp in parks during certain hours because they have nowhere else to go. But the city is also allowed to move people every 72 hours, so they aren't able to settle down. And so what that looks like is every few days, police officers visit the parks and post notices on people's tents, telling them to move along or they'll be fined. So then they get up and they move their stuff to another park and the cycle starts over. So they feel unwelcome because of those laws, but they also feel unwelcome because of the kind of reaction of the wider community. People they used to consider their neighbors. You know, it's really common at night for trucks to drive through the parks and honk and for people to yell out the car windows at tents telling them to get a job or get out of the park. And, you know, sometimes people who are out there camping face threats and even violence, too.
I know that you talked to one woman named Laura Gutowski. Can you talk a little bit about her and, like, how she has experienced this?
Laura's pretty extraordinary.
A few tents have moved in and then moved out again. Yeah. There's a few more in the back than there were before.
Because different people are sort of on different timelines.
Yeah. And
she's 55. She's been unhoused off and on since 2021 when her husband died suddenly and unexpectedly. And after that, you know, she didn't have a steady job. She didn't have a good income or savings. And pretty soon she found herself living in her car. Then her car broke down and it was impounded. She lost it. And that's when she moved into the parks. Laura's disabled. She has a bad knee and a bad back and had a really bad staph infection in her leg. And these are all conditions that are made worse by living outside.
My feet looked like Fiona Shrek feet. And my legs were, my ankles were like this big.
Yeah.
And because of the thin skin, I ended up getting blisters very easily, which would pop, and then I got staph infection.
Oh, my God.
And
it's like these things have a way of compounding.
Like snowballing, like you wouldn't believe. And actually, my legs got so bad that my skin was like mush.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, it was like yuck.
She uses a walker, which makes it hard to get in and out of her tent. But she also has this really great sense of humor, and she's clearly a source of comfort and wisdom for younger unhoused folks. People in the parks know her as Mama Bear.
This isn't just a community, it's a family.
Yeah.
Dysfunctional as it may be. More so, I think, than any other Thanksgiving table, but still family. We protect, we feed, shelter, clothes, whatever, you know. A lot of them will give the shirt off their back if you need it, even if it's 20 degrees.
Yeah.
Wow. And in terms of the experiences that you described of having to move every 3 days, being treated in a way that makes it clear that they're not exactly welcome, what did she say about that kind of stuff?
So when I met Laura, she was camping in Morrison Park, park with a baseball diamond where her son used to play Little League. And the park is less than a mile away from her former house. So this is like her neighborhood that she's living in now and that she's unhoused in. And, you know, I think that makes every day a really emotional experience. And she said the longer she spends in the parks, kind of the more upset she gets because she sees how the city's policies kind of play out day to day. And she feels like the city is trying to force her to leave the place that she's called home for decades.
The more I've been out here, the more angry I get because I've noticed that they're trying to push us out altogether. They're not trying to make things better for us or help us have another shelter or keep us safe. or helpless even medically or mentally. Yeah. They're just trying to push until we give up and say, fine, I'll leave town. Yeah. If they could have a few buses and load us up on buses right. and ship us out to the middle of the desert somewhere, they would. Yeah. If they felt that we couldn't retaliate and sue them, hell yeah, they would.
You can hear how angry and frustrated she is by the situation. I'm curious what the city would say to that, this idea that at least the people who are sleeping outside here feel that they are actively being pushed out.
Yeah, the city would say that the situation in the parks has created a public health hazard, and that public health hazard outweighs any other considerations. And the city would point to instances of drug abuse in the park, especially around, you know, playgrounds. And that's one thing that makes neighbors kind of uncomfortable about this situation. They don't feel that it's safe to bring their kids to the parks, or that, you know, the parks have become clogged with people's tents and belongings. And I think the city would say this is the only option that they have, is to move people out because it's created a health hazard. But then, of course, Laura and other people like her would say they have nowhere else to go.
Yeah, well, I mean, people are being asked to move every 3 days. They don't want a permanent encampment. Then is there another option? Like, are there shelters that they are asking people to go to instead?
Yeah, Laura's on several housing waiting lists, but there are no homeless shelters in Grants Pass. And
really?
This is actually a really important point, because, you know, when homeless people say that they have nowhere else to go, that's what they mean. There are actually no shelter beds, and there are really no affordable housing units available. The one place in the city that looks most like a shelter is run by a Christian nonprofit, and it's more of a transitional housing program. And it definitely works for some people and has helped them. And it's been running in the city for 40 years and has lifted people out of homelessness. But it's not a low-barrier shelter. There are a lot of strict rules. You have to attend chapel service twice a day. You have to abstain from substances and romantic relationships. The organization forces you to abide by the pronouns you were assigned at birth, so unhoused trans people don't feel welcome there. And you have to participate in a work program, so, you know, disabled folks also find it difficult. But, you know, as far as a federally certified homeless shelter, Grants Pass does not have one.
Wow. Are there any other ways in which the city or the people in that community are trying to help people who are living outside for now, or trying to get them into permanent housing, or find them a more sustainable solution?
Yeah, like a lot of places struggling with this, there are legions of volunteers in Grants Pass who, you know, pour their whole lives into helping people who live on the streets. There's one group called Mint that helps people with everything from medical needs to job interview advice to signing up for subsidized housing waiting lists. So there are a lot of people who want to help. But there are also people who are, you know, more hostile to the presence of unhoused people in the parks. And, you know, a majority of the city council favors laws that would allow police to clear encampments at all times, regardless of whether there's a shelter. Mm. The city's mayor, Sarah Bristol, has a more nuanced view. She wants the city to get its parks back, but she knows that they need to build more shelters and more affordable housing units, and they need to do it fast. So, you know, like in many places, there's this political fight that's playing out there as well.
After the break, we'll hear the arguments on each side of this case and why so many other local and state governments are invested in the outcome. We'll be right back.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Hannah Rosen, host of Radio Atlantic.
Wait, really?
Every week, we talk to Atlantic writers or other creative thinkers, and we take one idea and we road test it.
Maybe what I'm asking is the problem them or us?
Sometimes I change my mind about things.
That's such a good point. I never thought of that.
Maybe you will, too. Or at least you might see something differently.
Ooh, that's fabulous.
Radio Atlantic. New episodes every Thursday.
So, Reese, as you say, what's happening in Grants Pass, it kind of is playing out in so many cities around the country where you have groups of people who are sleeping outside and this question of, like, what should be done, if anything. But not all of these cases make their way all the way to the Supreme Court. Can you tell me a little bit about how this issue became a legal case and how it became a Supreme Court case?
Yeah, it all started with a lawsuit in 2018. It was filed against Grants Pass on behalf of three unhoused individuals, Deborah Blake, Gloria Johnson, and John Logan. They'd all been homeless in Grants Pass for years, and they'd racked up thousands of dollars in fines because of the city's anti-camping laws. So that case has been winding its way through the court system for years since then. In 2021, actually, Deborah Blake died, and she was still homeless at the time. So the two other plaintiffs, Gloria Johnson and John Logan, are now the lead plaintiffs in the case.
So then what are these plaintiffs arguing? Like, what is their legal position for why what the city is doing should not be allowed?
Yeah, so the core issue in this case is whether governments can punish people for camping or sleeping outside, specifically when they have nowhere else to go. And what the unhoused plaintiffs are arguing is that Grants Pass is punishing them for a status that they can't control. They're homeless, not through any fault of their own, and they're being punished because of it. And they say that is a violation of the Eighth Amendment, specifically the cruel and unusual punishment clause, because it essentially, they say, criminalizes them for existing.
And so what does the city say in response to that? Like, what are their lawyers arguing?
My colleague Anne Marimo spoke with a lead attorney for the city, Theane Evangelis, who said that cities across the country need maximum flexibility to deal with a problem as complicated as homelessness.
If the Supreme Court were to agree with the Ninth Circuit, then cities across the country would find their hands tied as they work to address the urgent homelessness crisis. We've seen that cities have been paralyzed and unable to address very dangerous, unsafe, and unhealthy encampments.
So the city says that they need these laws because encampments pose a health risk to unhoused and housed residents alike, and they need ordinances like this in order to clear encampments and control encampments. But that's not actually the central issue in this case. The case is not about whether cities can clear encampments. In fact, cities are allowed to do so, and Grants Pass has continued to, every 72 hours, clear its parks' encampments. The central issue of this case is whether governments can punish people with fines and jail time for sleeping and living outside when they have nowhere else to go. And that last part is really key here. When a city lacks available shelter beds, the question is, can that city punish people for camping outside?
Interesting. So I see where the idea of violating the cruel and unusual punishment clause comes in, where people are saying, well, I don't have any place else to go. I don't have the money to pay this fine. And yet I'm being fined. I'm being put in jail for something that I have literally no control over. And you're not helping me.
Right. The unhoused say that these laws essentially make it a crime to be living and breathing in Grants Pass if you are homeless.
So what has been the reaction to this case, especially considering the fact that this is an issue that so many cities and towns and state governments are trying to deal with also?
This case is being closely watched by governments all over the country. And you can tell just by looking at the list of amicus briefs on the Supreme Court's website. You'll see places like Honolulu, San Francisco, Montana, Maryland, and even the Biden administration. All of them asked the court to weigh in because they all know how complex homelessness is. And everyone wants more clarity on what sorts of laws they're able to use to address it. And the case has created some unusual alliances. Liberal cities like Portland and Sacramento and Seattle are joined with deep red states like Florida and Alabama to ask the court to uphold the Grants Pass laws, saying, you know, essentially, homelessness is this huge problem, and we need laws like this to help regulate it.
That is so interesting to me that in some ways, this is like the rare bipartisan issue that that government leaders want to have the ability to clear homeless encampments and prevent people from sleeping outside. Why do you think that is? Like, why do you think that this kind of cuts across political lines?
Yeah, I mean, just looking at that list of amicus briefs and even the fact that a small city like Grants Pass is the one in front of the Supreme Court right now, I think that just shows how widespread this crisis has become. But these arguments, I think, also show that leaders, even of more liberal places, are feeling this intense pressure to crack down on visible homelessness and encampments, and they're embracing more hardline approaches than they have in the past.
And I don't want to undersell the fact that this is a really complicated issue that doesn't have any easy answers. And obviously, like, political leaders are dealing with this on a logistical level, but it's also such a salient political issue, you know? Like, I do feel like you're seeing in elections all around the country politicians who are hearing from voters that, like, we don't like seeing big encampments of people in our downtowns. It makes us feel unsafe. It makes us feel like our city is going to pot. And that, like, I do wonder if this is also a reflection of the kind of political blowback that a lot of politicians, Republican or Democrat, are noticing.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And lawyers for the unhoused plaintiffs say that, you know, all those cities and counties, all those leaders who are complaining that blocking these rules would allow encampments to multiply, they're all just performing a kind of political sleight of hand where they're deflecting blame from decades of failed housing policy. And there's some truth to that. You know, the core problem here is that there is not enough housing and not enough shelter beds in most places across the country. The flip side, of course, is that correcting that problem is going to be really difficult and is going to take a long time.
When you talk to experts on homelessness or people who have been trying to find solutions to this problem for a while, do they buy that argument that ultimately these parks are a public health hazard or a safety hazard, and that this is basically an unsafe way to exist?
Well, I think nobody is happy with the situation. On either side, no one wants masses of people living outside in unsafe environments where there's not access to, you know, running water and toilet facilities, and there's drug use all around people. I think the issue is how to address that and where the blame ultimately falls. But I don't think anyone is contesting that the situation in encampments across the country is, you know, is dire.
And what is the solution? I mean, what are the kinds of policies or ideas that these cities and towns and local governments could be putting in place that would help this problem and get people out of homeless encampments without, like, having to fine them or put them in jail?
Well, I think the most sustainable long-term solution is kind of simple, and not to be reductive, but it's basically like build more housing. You know, this is at its core a housing crisis because there aren't enough places, much less affordable mm-hmm. places for people to live, and that crunch has driven, you know, record number of people onto the streets.
So once the Supreme Court does rule on this issue, what are the potential consequences? Like, what kinds of implications could there be for unhoused people and for governments who have been trying to figure out how to deal with this issue?
So the court could issue a range of decisions, but, you know, very basically, if it decides in favor of Grants Pass, that means the city would be able to enforce its strict camping ban at all hours of the day and in all public places. And for unhoused folks, you know, that would mean likely mass displacement because they simply wouldn't have anywhere else to go in the city where they could be without getting ticketed. And if the court rules in favor of the unhoused folks, then that means they would get to remain in parks at least until a shelter is created. But, you know, at the end of the day, there will still be, no matter what, between 600 and 1,200 people looking for a place to go and a place to sleep.
You know, I don't know if Laura has had much of a chance to think about, like, how this Supreme Court ruling could potentially affect her personally. But I do wonder, like, did she share anything with you just about what she's thinking for the future for herself and what she wants her life to look like?
Yeah, Laura's been trying, you know, desperately to get off the street, and she's on all of these housing waiting lists. And when I asked her about what she hopes for the future, she said, you know, I just want my own kitchen. She grew up cooking and loved to make meals for her family.
When I'm cooking, like, especially pasta or Italian meals, I love throwing stuff in and doing different things. They're like, ooh, what you making? And I'm like, mystery dinner. They're like, awesome, cool. Yeah. My husband always knew if I didn't have a name for it, it was going to be freaking good.
She wants to be able to do that again, and she wants to have a cast iron cooking set like she used to have and make tuna casserole and eggplant parmesan. And when she thinks about the future, that vision is what gives her hope.
Reese, thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Reese Thibeau is the West Coast correspondent for The Post. Like I said, the Supreme Court heard the oral argument in this case today, and the reactions were mixed. The court's justices expressed concern about punishing people sleeping outside when they have nowhere else to go. But they also struggled with how to make sure that government officials have the flexibility to deal with this growing crisis. Justice Elena Kagan, one of the liberals on the court, described sleeping as, quote, a biological necessity.
It's sort of like breathing. I mean, you could say breathing is conduct, too. but presumably you would not think that it's okay to criminalize breathing in public.
I would like to point to the federal regulations.
And for a homeless person who has no place to go, sleeping in public is kind of like breathing in public.
Meanwhile, Chief Justice John Roberts, a conservative, questioned why they, instead of lawmakers, should be the ones making decisions to address this problem.
Many people have mentioned this is a serious policy problem. And it's a policy problem because the solution, of course, is to build shelter, to provide shelter for those who are otherwise harmless. But municipalities have competing priorities. I mean, what if there are lead pipes in the water? Do you build the homeless shelter or do you take care of the lead pipes? What if there isn't enough fire protection? Which one do you prioritize? Why would you think that these nine people are the best people to judge and weigh those policy judgments?
A decision on this case is expected in late June. The Supreme Court case was, of course, just one of many big news events that happened today. Here are some other stories that I've had my eye on. Protests against the Israel-Gaza war are continuing on college campuses in the Northeast, and things are getting more serious. At Yale, more than 40 pro-Palestinian demonstrators were arrested on Monday. And at Columbia, in-person classes were canceled because of the protests. And the Biden administration on Monday announced new rules intended to protect the privacy of patients seeking abortions and the health workers who may have provided those abortions. This change affects HIPAA, the health privacy law that's nearly 30 years old. The new policy stops doctors and insurers from sharing patient information with state officials who are conducting investigations, filing lawsuits, or prosecuting patients or providers. At a press conference on Monday, Melanie Fontes-Rayner with the Department of Health and Human Services talked about why this new rule is necessary.
No one should have to live in fear that their conversations with their doctor or that their medical claims data might be used to target or track them for seeking lawful reproductive health care.
That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Sabi Robinson. It was mixed by Sean Carter and edited by Lucy Perkins. Thank you also to Anne Marimo. If you love the show, help other people discover it by leaving a rating on Spotify or a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It truly does help other people find our show. I'm Martine Powers. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.
If you're looking for a smoking gun, I can absolutely guarantee you, you will not find it.
In October 2001, a series of letters filled with a deadly powder called anthrax were dropped into the U.S. mail system. What started as an unprecedented case turned into an unsettling mystery. Who sent these deadly letters? And why? From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, I'm Josh Dean, and this is Cover Up Season 4, The Anthrax Threat. Available now.